Now, Brother David Bruce will tell us about priests and kings of God.
Thank you, Brother Jim. Well, our convention's almost over. Kind of a sad time, in a way, because I don't think any of us like to see conventions end. And this is the last chance. You know, it kind of reminds me of, you know, sometimes as you're going along the highway, just before we get on a freeway, it's the last chance to fill up with gas before you get on the freeway. Because sometimes it's some of these new freeways, you know, that we have, the gas stations are a far distance apart. And so they like to tell you that it's the last chance to fill up. Well, this is kind of the last chance to fill up, because this is it. I know David has some remarks that he said he's going to make, and he indicated it's going to be short, but this is going to be the last chance to really fill up on something. I hope it's profitable to you, and I hope it'll drive you on your way to the destination that you've marked out for yourself as a new creature in Christ Jesus. Because that's what we all want. Something that'll give us a little horsepower to climb over the mountains and the difficulties that face us from time to time in our Christian walk. And we all have them, whether we don't like them necessarily, but yet they're necessary to develop us and to develop our stamina and to develop our love for the Lord. So I'm sure, as far as I'm concerned, that the convention has done this for me. It has provided me with much needed energy, a little bit of fuel, and a greater determination to serve the Lord, maybe just a little better than I have been. The word priest, you know, is used to describe an individual who is devoted to the service of God. Now, at an early age, and I don't know when this happened, but at an early age, the word priest in my mind was associated with the Catholic Church. I thought that they had invented the priesthood as a means of keeping the common people in ignorance and in subjection to the wishes of the Church. And even today, you know, whenever I hear the word priest, my first idea is to reject it. I don't like it. Because of my parents' experiences, I suppose, in Europe, and later their great joy at being released from this domination of the Catholic system that kept the people poor. Poor in spiritual things and poor in material things also. And it was a long time before I learned that the God of heaven had set up a priesthood, really, which was intended to serve the people, which was intended to help enrich their lives spiritually as well as in material things. If I ask you the question, when was this priesthood established? Your answer would probably be that it was established after the deliverance of the children of Israel through Moses. And it would be what I would expect you to say. Because in Leviticus, the 8th chapter, we're given a detailed account of the consecration of Aaron and his son. And then in Leviticus, the 9th chapter, we're given the detailed account of the inauguration of Aaron and his son. But you know, as you read the 8th and 9th chapters of Leviticus, you probably never noticed that not one single time is it recorded that Aaron and his sons are to be priests, and that Aaron is to be the high priest. You read it through and see if you can find any instance where in the 8th or 9th chapter of Leviticus it refers to that process that's described there as the consecration of the priesthood or the inauguration of the priesthood. It's not there. However, the term priest is used in other places. in connection with both Aaron and his sons. So we still can properly use the expression that Leviticus 8 describes the consecration of the priesthood, and that Leviticus 9 describes the inauguration of the priesthood. So it's just kind of a peculiar thing that within the chapters themselves there's no mention of the fact that they will be priests. Now, there was, however, a priesthood of a sort that was acceptable to God before this time. Did you know that? Of course you did. There was a priesthood that was established by God before the Aaronic priesthood, and you all know it. The question came to mind, you know, to me, well, how did the people conduct a worship and offer sacrifices to God before this time? Well, as it turns out, the arrangement seemed to be that the firstborn, or the head of the household, could act as a priest. Or perhaps a better way to say it would be that he could perform the duties of a priest. And in some cases, they were actually called priests. And Genesis 14:18 tells us of a very famous priest. Who was it? It was Melchizedek. Says he was not only a priest, but he was a king. He was a king of Salem. Remember, there it says he was a king of Salem, and he brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. That means, as far as God's word is concerned, they placed the stamp of approval on him and said that he was a priest of the Most High God. And this was before Aaron, the Aaronic priesthood, was established, wasn't it? And then, of course, it goes on to says that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. And there were others, too, that acted in the capacity of a priest. There was Abel, even, who, in a sense, acted as a priest because he offered a sacrifice. And it was accepted by God. Abraham, too, did the same at various places where he built altars, you remember. And we're not going to mention all the instances because you know where they are as well as I do. Jacob did the same. And then also Moses, before he left Egypt. You remember he went to Pharaoh and he wanted permission to go 3 days' journey into the wilderness. For what purpose? To offer sacrifices to God. How were they going to offer sacrifices? Well, they must have had some arrangement that was acceptable to God that had been told to Moses would be acceptable so that they would be able to offer these sacrifices to God. And then when Moses went up in the mount, before the Aaronic priesthood was established, we have in Exodus 19:22 the account that God tells Moses not to have the priests come up with him, but just to take Aaron with him. So it appears that God had approved some in the past who did act as priests, and in some cases even called them, as in the case of Melchizedek, priests. And they were acceptable in his sight, and this happened before the Aaronic priesthood was established. All right, now, from the text in Exodus 13:12, we see that God had decreed that the firstborn among the children of Israel were his. He said that thou shalt set apart unto the Lord all that openeth the matrix, and every firstling that comes of a beast which thou hast, the male shall be the Lord's. And then in Numbers, the third chapter, verses 12 and 13, he makes a very practical decision. In order to have the priesthood and those who would serve the priesthood, he says that rather than divide up all the families and take the firstborn of this one out and take the firstborn here and take the firstborn from him, this family and that family, and gather them all together and make a new entity entirely out of them, he says that what he's going to do, he says, we're going to make an exchange. In Numbers 3, let's read it. Numbers, the third chapter, verses 12 and 13. He says, "And I, behold, I have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel instead of all the firstborn that openeth the matrix among the children of Israel. Therefore, the Levites shall be mine. Because all the firstborn are mine, for on that day that I smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I hallowed unto me all the firstborn in Israel, both man and beast. Mine shall that be. I am the Lord." So God said, "Well, I'm just going to take the tribe of Levi instead of the firstborn, and the tribe of Levi is going to be mine just as the firstborn were mine. Then I'll give up my rights to the firstborn." Now the question comes to mind, well, why did God choose the Levites? Why not one of the other tribes? Why not Judah's tribe or Reuben or one of the others? Why did God choose the Levi? What made Levi's tribe so special? Who was he? Did God make the choice at this time, or did he make it a long time before? Well, Levi, remember, was one of the sons of Jacob through Leah. He was the number three son. And as one of the sons of Jacob, he had a right to a portion of the promised land, but something happened to this right. Sometime before this exchange of the Levites for the firstborn was proposed by God. Remember when Jacob was about to die, he gathered together all of his sons. He says, "Come on, I want to talk to you before I die." And he had a little chat with them. Genesis 49, verse 1 says, "And Jacob called unto his sons and said, Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days." Then we skip to verse 5. And he says, "Simeon and Levi," and we're especially interested in Levi, "Simeon and Levi are brethren, instruments of cruelty are in their habitations." Then goes to verse 7. "Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Well, what does this mean? He says, "I'm going to divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Well, I think this is a prophecy concerning Levi and Simeon as to what would happen when they came into the land, that they would not, for some reason, they would not receive a certain area in which to dwell as the others would. They would be divided among Jacob and scattered throughout the land. Well, why did Jacob do this to Levi and Simeon also? Although, as I say, we're especially interested in Levi. Well, a hint is given when he says, "Their wrath was cruel." Well, what had happened? Well, in Genesis, the 34th chapter, you know when Brother Jerry Leslie was talking, he almost took... I thought he was going to take my talk away the way he was going, but he stopped in time for me to still use this lesson. In Genesis, the 34th chapter, we read that Dinah, who is Levi's sister, is evidently a very pretty girl. And evidently somebody else thought she was pretty, because I remember when I was quite young, there was a song that, "Dinah, is there anyone finer?" You know, and so they must have read about this account in Genesis. But Dinah must have been a very fine girl, very pretty girl, and she was noticed by the prince of Shechem. You know, he fell for her just like a ton of bricks. And he thought she was the prettiest thing alive, and he evidently just couldn't control himself. And he liked her so much that it says he defiled her, not waiting to get permission to marry her, although he really had fallen in love with her. And he wanted to marry her. In fact, he gets his father to go to Jacob and plead his cause with Jacob, and to get Jacob's permission to marry Dinah. Of course, when Jacob hears about this incident, he's very upset. And then when Levi comes in from the field, he's very angry too. But Levi hides his anger, however, and it says he deceives Shechem. And then he makes Shechem a proposition. He makes him this proposition. He said, "Now, if you and all the men of Shechem will agree to get circumcised, okay, we will give you permission to marry Dinah. In fact, not only that, but we also will intermarry with your women. But if you don't agree to this, there's nothing doing. So Shechem and his father Hamor, now they like Jacob and the rest of the family. They figure they're a good addition to the community. They've settled there. They've even bought the land. And so they go to their men of the city, and they all agree to this rite. Now, 3 days later, when the men are kind of convalescing from this circumcision, what happens? Simeon and Levi come into town, and they kill all the men, and eventually take a spoil of all the sheep and cattle and wealth, even to taking the women and children. Now, what's Jacob's reaction to this? Well, I'll tell you, he didn't like that either. In verse 30, we read, Jacob said to Simeon and to Levi, "Ye have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house." And they said, should he deal with our sisters with an harlot? They thought they had a good excuse for doing what they did. But Jacob said, you've made a mess of things now, that you've made me to stink among all these inhabitants. And evidently Jacob carried this sad remembrance of this event with him all through his life. And here on his deathbed in Genesis the 49th chapter, he pronounced that what this that would happen to Levi and to Simeon because of what they did, that they'd be scattered throughout the land. And the Levites, as the assistants to the priesthood, were scattered throughout the land. This was what had happened to, now the priesthood was in one place, and then the Levites were scattered throughout the land in order to more or less act as, well, I think policemen, to keep the worship of God pure among the people. They were sort of guardians of the faith, because evidently experience had shown how easily the people would fall into idolatry, and how necessary it was that there should be a body of men scattered throughout the nation, just as Jacob said they would be, as guardians of the true worship of God. And because without this arrangement, the purity of God's worship would not be maintained, and idolatry would quickly become a form of worship. They were sort of spiritual policemen. Of course, even with this arrangement, we see that the people would vacillate anyway. But this evidently was the reason for the Levites being scattered in amongst the rest of the tribes. Now, in a sense, I think we can see why Levi was chosen for this purpose of replacing the firstborn. Levi and his tribe, that is. Levi, who had become so angry and who had defended his sister's purity and had executed vengeance upon Shechem in such a bloodthirsty manner, was probably the one who had the natural tendency to be strong in keeping the faith and the worship of God pure, even though it would mean the shedding of blood. He would go to any lengths, if he went to any lengths to keep the, or to protect the purity of his sister, certainly he would go to any lengths to protect the purity of the worship of God. They had manifested extraordinary zeal. Okay? All right. But now someone says, now wait a minute. Levi isn't the only one upon whom this pronouncement was made. Simeon had this pronouncement made on him too. And I say, that's right. Well, what happened to Simeon? Didn't Simeon get a piece of the land? Well, I was kind of stumped by that. I really was. And quite by accident, my attention was drawn to a text in Judges, the 19th chapter. And I think this shows that Simeon really did not get a portion of the land the way the rest of his brethren did, and that this pronouncement of Jacob's was accurately fulfilled. Listen to what Judges 19:1 says. And it came to pass in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite sojourning on the side of Mount Ephraim. That's not the one I want. I want Joshua. Joshua 19. I have Joshua written down here and I can't see it. It's Joshua the 19th chapter. The first verse. And a second lot came forth to Simeon. Now they were casting lots for that portion of the land on which they would all dwell. The second lot came forth to Simeon, even for the tribe of the children of Simeon, according to their families. And their inheritance was within the inheritance of the children of Judah. Now to me, that means that Judah was given some land, and then Simeon was told, well, you dwell in here with the Judah people, with the tribe of Judah. You dwell here with them, rather than having a separate piece of land just for themselves. And the ninth verse does the same, says the same thing, a little more detail. It says, out of the portion of the children of Judah was the inheritance of the children of Simeon. For the part of children of Judah was too much for them. Therefore the children of Simeon had their inheritance within the inheritance of them. So to me, the pronouncement of Jacob came to pass just as Jacob had said it would, that they were divided in Jacob and scattered throughout the land. Now we're all familiar with the consecration of the priesthood, that is Aaron and his sons. But do you know how the Levites were consecrated? What did they have to do? Where is it recorded? Now, I'm sure that 99% of everybody here would be able to tell me where the consecration of the priesthood is recorded for us. Leviticus 8th chapter. Everybody knows that. And the 9th chapter is the inauguration of the priesthood. But where is the consecration of the Levites recorded? Well, it's in Exodus, the 32nd chapter, verses 25 to 29. And, you know, that's a hard number to remember, because we don't have studies time after time on this matter of the Levites being consecrated. And it's hard for me to remember that number, Exodus 32, 25 to 29. So what I've done, I put it beside the Leviticus 8 chapter, where I know where the consecration of Levites or the priesthood is. And I put down there, for the consecration of the Levites, see Exodus 32, 25 to 29. That way I never forget where to look for it, at least. Leviticus 8 will let me find both the consecration of the priesthood now and the consecration of the Levites. Exodus 32, 25 to 29. It says there, and when Moses saw that the people were naked... And, you know, this is the incident, you remember, right after Moses had come down from the mountain with the tables of the law and found the people reveling and rioting and had Aaron make this golden calf for them and so on. It says, when Moses saw that the people were naked, for Aaron had made them naked under their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, who is on the Lord's side? Let him come to me. And all the sons of Levi, now you notice all the sons of Levi, gathered themselves together unto him. And he said unto them, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, put every man his sword by his side, and go in and out from gate to gate throughout the camp, and slay every man his brother, and every man his companion, and every man his neighbor. And the children of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And there fell of the people that day about 3,000 men. For Moses had said, consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, even every man upon his son and upon his brother, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day. here we have the consecration of the Levites. It seems that it's as if God wanted the Israelites to be reminded of the zeal of this family. Reminded of the original zeal of Levi in protecting the purity of his sister and their ability to go to any lengths to preserve the purity of their faith and the worship of the true God. Now, is there a lesson here for us in this consecration of the Levites? Well, some will say, oh no, that this doesn't affect us because we are shown in the picture of Leviticus 8, the consecration of the priesthood. Well, that's the wrong answer. I think we can be shown in this consecration picture of the Levites. Well, you say, how? Well, again, we know the incidents that led up to this event. The people of Israel had been delivered out of bondage. Then after some time it elapsed, they were grumbling about their conditions. And while Moses was up on the mount getting the law, they had almost rebelled against Aaron. So Aaron, probably against his better judgment, had bowed to the will of the people, built a golden calf for them to worship, and then to let them go. And in addition, the people became grossly immoral, so that when Moses came back, finally found the people dancing and worshiping this image, contrary to all of God's commandments. So Moses destroyed the calf, and they had a confrontation in which Moses said, "Who's on the Lord's side? Let him come to me." And all the tribe of Levi, sons of Levi, that gathered themselves unto him. Now, I'm sure that we can all see a parallel to this series of events that has occurred in our lives. In this typical picture, I think, that's recorded for us, we may have even had the experience of worshiping the true God and having a knowledge of the truth to a degree. We hadn't made a consecration, but we had a knowledge of the truth. As a child, I was brought up in the truth. So were many of you. And I knew the truth, the plan of God, and I loved God because of what I knew his plan was for mankind. But then maybe we went back on it, on this knowledge, for just a little while. And that has a parallel in my life. May not have in your life, but I went out into the world. I thought, well, I'm going to enjoy myself for just a little while anyway. I'll serve God later, you know. But I want to enjoy myself. And then I was faced with a crisis time in my life. Maybe you had the same experience. Israelites did. They had a confrontation with Moses. And then when we're faced with this crisis time in our lives where we had to make a decision, whose side are we on? Hopefully, like the Levites, we gather ourselves to the antitypical Moses, our Lord. Because that's what happened in my life. I was faced with a crisis time, and I said, what am I doing over here? It's really not where I want to be. And I gathered myself to the Lord, and I gave my heart to the Lord. Now, that's not the end of the matter. You know, just coming over and declaring themselves to be on the side of Moses was not the end of the matter for the Levites. And it's not the end of the matter for us just to say that we love the Lord and we are on the Lord's side. In order now to complete our consecration, our antitypical Moses tells us to go back into the camp and slay. Kill our brother, our companion, and our neighbor. What does that mean? Well, of course, it means we're not literally to do any killing. We know that. So it has a symbolic meaning. I think it's very clear. It means that all relationships that we may have from this point on, from the time we've made a consecration, all relationships with our neighbor, our brother, and our companions are to be cut off, slain or killed. You know, once an individual is slain, we can have no more contact with that person, can we? That is, any meaningful contact. We can maybe touch them when they're slain, but we can't have any meaningful contact with them anymore, any meaningful relationship with them anymore. And that's exactly what our consecration means, too. It means the end of any meaningful contact with anyone who is not on the Lord's side. Now, notice we said we did not mean that we cut off all contact. We know that Jesus didn't go into a retreat and just cut himself off from everybody with no contact with the world. What it means is we have no meaningful contact with the world. We have to still earn a living and depend in many respects on the goodwill of people in the world for many things. But we do cut them off. We do cut them off from any part in our lives where contact with them endangers our eternal destiny. That's what consecration is all about. So this then is a picture that we can use profitably to tell us and illustrate to us what consecration should be and how it should find a parallel in our lives in order to completely carry out the will of God for us. Well, I'm going to change the subject now. Getting back to this matter of the exchange of the Levites for the firstborn, you know, we find something interesting happens in this connection. In Numbers, the third chapter, Moses is instructed to count how many males there are from the age of 1 month up and upward are in the tribe of Levi. And in verse 39 of Numbers 3, we're told that there are 22,000. 22,000 males from the age of 1 month on up. And then Moses is told to count how many firstborn males there are in Israel, all of the 12 tribes. In verse 43, we're told that there are 22,273. So now we have a problem. You see, God has been kind of short-changed a little bit here. He has a right to have 22,273 firstborn over here, but over here in the tribe of Levi, there's only 22,000 males. Only 22,000 here. So he's being short-changed by 273 people. So how does God solve the problem? Well, it's easy. He tells Moses that in order to make it an even exchange, he's to get 5 shekels in cash from them, and the money's to go to Aaron. In other words, for these 273 that he's shortchanged, he's supposed to get 5 shekels in cash. That's in verses 46 to 48. Now, the question is, you know, who's going to pay the 5 shekels? Is it going to be you, this one over here, or that one, or is it going to be you over here and over here? Here we got 22,000 that are going to get exchanged for 22,000 going to be exchanged for 22,273. But which one of these 22,273 are going to pay the 5 shekels? Somebody in this group is going to pay 5 shekels to the priest, to Aaron. But how do you decide? Well, you know, the scriptures don't tell us. We just don't. We're not told in the Bible. But according to the Talmud, it was by a lottery system. And I don't know if this is right or not. But this is what the Talmud says. It says that Moses wrote the word Levite on 22,000 tickets. Okay? 22,000 against 22,000. Then on 273 tickets, he wrote the word 5 shekels cash. Then he mixed them all up. And the 22,273 males marched through the camp, picked up a ticket. If it said Levite, they were home free. If it said 5 shekels cash, they had to pay the 5 shekels cash to the high priest. Now, as I say, I don't know if that's the way it was done or not, but that's what the Talmud tells us was done. And it sounds like that's one way to do it. So now we have the Levites all exchanged, one for the other. And the priesthood has, Aaron has 1,365 shekels in cash. Well, that took care of the exchange. All right. Now, in order to serve in the tabernacle arrangement, there was an age requirement. In Numbers, the fourth chapter, verses 3, 23, and 30, and 39, and so on, tells the age requirement that's given is from 30 years old and upward until 50 years old. From 30 to 50. After 50, they retired. They had a better system than we had. We had to wait till we were 62 before we can retire, and 65 if we're going to collect full pay. But here, they can retire at the age of 50. From 30 to 50. All right? But, you know, we have a problem, because in Numbers, the 8th chapter, verses 24 and 25, it gives the age requirement as being from 25 to 50 years. So we have a difference here of 5 years. One chapter says you're supposed to serve from 25 to 50, and the other one says from 30 to 50 years of age. So which one do you believe? Well, I suppose it depends if you want to work or not. But I notice the Septuagint gives the age requirements of both Numbers 4 and Numbers 8 as being from 25 to 50, but I don't know whether that's good enough authority to accept the 8th chapter version as it's given in the King James, that the age requirement is from 25 to 50. And one attempt to explain the difference between the two, rather than accepting the Septuagint version, is that some have suggested that the Numbers 8 account, that difference of 5 years, may have been intended as a kind of a training time, when the trainee would work along with the one who had the experience, and then by the time they got to be 30, by then they could do it alone. Now, I don't know which one you want to take. It doesn't really matter to me. We're not under that law arrangement anyway, but this is just kind of an interesting sidelight to this whole matter of the priesthood and the Levites that I thought you might be interested in. Now, in Numbers, the 8th chapter, there's some more requirements needed in addition to the age requirement before they could serve in the tabernacle. Numbers, the 8th chapter, we read verses 5 to 7 and then verses 8 to 14. says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Take the Levites from among the children of Israel and cleanse them. And thus shalt thou do unto them to cleanse them, sprinkle water of purifying upon them, and let them shave all their flesh, and let them wash their clothes, and so make themselves clean." Now, you see, they're going to purify them by this water of purifying. Now, that's the same water that was used in connection with those who had touched a dead body. You know, my memory's the thing I forget. With that, what is it? It's got ashes of a red heifer, and something else and something else, the scarlet thread, and what else, David? Hyssop. All right, hyssop and ashes of a red heifer and so on. But this mixture with the water is the same water that's used here to cleanse the ones who are going to serve in the tabernacle. And then it says, not only you got to wash them, but you got to shave them. Shave all the hair off them. I don't know if that means the head too or not. There's all the hair. It says shave all their flesh, and I would imagine that means their hair too. And then it says, let them wash their clothes and so make themselves clean. Well, antitypically, I think that means a complete washing of the sins of the flesh, the natural tendencies that we may have, that we have received from Father Adam. Go into a lot more detail now, but we're going to stop there. And then verses 8 to 14 tell us there's something else that has to be required. It says, "Then let them take a young bullock with his meat offering, even fine flour mingled with oil, and another young bullock shalt thou take for a sin offering. And thou shalt bring the Levites before the tabernacle of the congregation, and thou shalt gather the whole assembly of the children of Israel together, and thou shalt bring the Levites before the Lord. And the children of Israel shall put their hands upon the Levites. And Aaron shall offer the Levites before the Lord for an offering of the children of Israel, that they may execute the service of the Lord. And the Levites shall lay their hands upon the heads of the bullocks, and thou shalt offer the one for a sin offering and the one for a burnt offering unto the Lord, to make an atonement for the Levites. And thou shalt set the Levites before Aaron and before his sons, and offer them for an offering unto the Lord. Thus shalt thou separate the Levites from among the children of Israel, and the Levites shall be mine. All right. So here, the Levites have to offer an acceptable sacrifice to God. Now, in our case, that would be a symbol of giving up something that's acceptable to God. It would mean, the Levites picture those who give up something that God can accept. And what is that? Well, the only thing that we have that would be acceptable to God would be our life rights in the next age. Our earthly life rights. Therefore, those whom the Levites picture cannot represent an earthly class, but they have to represent a spiritual class. And this is one of the points that we want to be sure that we get from this picture, that just as the Levites in this picture had to offer a sacrifice that was acceptable to God, so the antitypical Levites, who are those of us, must also offer an acceptable sacrifice to God. And the only thing that we have is that which Jesus bought with his own blood, our life rights in the next age. And so, once you give it up, you can't take it back. God doesn't allow that. And so, the Levites here picture a class that has to be on the spirit plane, or if we're once members of this Levite class and we are not faithful, why then we go into second death. But we cannot be an earthly class. And that's one thing that we would want you to kind of remember from this lesson. Because, unfortunately, some are teaching otherwise, that the Greek company can be an earthly class and is going to be an earthly class. But we don't so believe. You know, it was to the Levites that God gave the duty of preserving the law and transcribing it and even interpreting it. They were, in a sense, like our Supreme Court. In Deuteronomy 17:12, we read, We read this, and the man that will do presumptuously and will not hearken unto the priest that standeth to minister there before the Lord thy God, or unto the judge, even that man shall die, and thou shalt put away the evil from Israel. Now what this is talking about is, here someone has been tried by the judge, and the man doesn't like the verdict that the judge has rendered. So he can go to the priest and appeal to the priest to render a judgment in the matter. And the priest then renders a judgment in the matter. In this particular case, the idea is that the priest renders the same judgment as the judge. And he says here that, now, if someone is presumptuous and won't hearken and won't accept this final verdict of the priest, then he says, that man shall die. It was death as a penalty for not obeying the priest and not accepting that which the priest had rendered as a final judgment. In Deuteronomy 31, verses 24 to 26, we have the statement that Moses commanded the Levites, which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law and put it in the side of the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there for a witness. So here the Levites were charged with the duty of preserving the law. Now the priests also were to read the law to the people. How often were they supposed to read the law to the people, would you say? Now if you were like me before I made up this talk, you'd say, why, they were supposed to read the law to the people once a year. Would that be right? Would that be what your answer would have been? Well, if that was your answer, it was wrong. Because in Deuteronomy, the 31st chapter, verses 10 to 13, may surprise some of you, it surprised me, it's one every 7 years. Deuteronomy 31, verses 10 to 13 says, and Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release in the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men, women, and children, and thy stranger that is within thy gates, that they may hear, and that they may learn, and fear the Lord your God, and observe to do all the words of this law. Once every 7 years, they were supposed to read the law to the people. And so this priesthood, this typical priesthood, was established along with the Levites who were to serve the priesthood. Now, there's much more that we could say about this whole arrangement. The priests had 13 cities where they could dwell permanently, and then the Levites were scattered all over the country. But what is important, more important to us, is this: that we are called and promised that greater reward of being a part of a priesthood that's to bless all the families of the earth, to be actually priests of God and even kings of God, of the Most High God, after the order of Melchizedek. We will be in a position of accepting the sacrifices of the people in that time, when all shall know him, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, because the knowledge of the Lord shall fill the earth, and to bring mankind back who are willing and obedient into harmony with God, just as the typical Aaronic priesthood did. Now, we said we're going to be priests and kings. Who do you think of when you think of a king? Well, I think of Solomon. You know, I want to be like Solomon. When Solomon was at his best, of course. Under Solomon, the nation of Israel reached the very zenith of their glory. Solomon's wisdom in dealing with the problems of that people must have been truly a wonder to all who could hear his thought processes. I think we all admire anyone who can take a problem and consider it from every angle and then come up with an answer that is just to all, that satisfies everybody. And Solomon was such a man. And when the Queen of Sheba came to see Solomon, she brought gifts. But that's not all she brought, because she brought to him questions, not just riddles that she was trying to trap him on, but she really brought questions about what she should do as to the problems of life and rulership of her people. And we all know what she said. Why, she said, the half of the greatness of thy wisdom was not told me. You see, God had answered Solomon's prayer that he might have a wise and understanding heart, that he might judge his people righteously. And this must be our prayer now. Notice Solomon prayed for an understanding heart. It's our heart that we are to develop now. The wisdom, just as in Solomon's case, will come from God when and if we are kings and priests of God in the next age. Are you trying to have an understanding heart? Am I trying to have an understanding heart, is the question. And my margin for that suggests another word for understanding heart. It says a hearing heart. A heart that hears the other person. But you know, in order to hear, we have to stop talking ourselves, don't we? Pretty hard to hear somebody else when we're talking ourselves. We have to stop telling them off and hear them out, to have a hearing heart. And under Solomon, the nation was at peace, and with peace the men worked the fields, and the flocks grew, and everyone prospered. Now, how did he achieve peace? Well, for one thing, he married the daughter of Pharaoh, so that made Egypt an ally. And then he next married the daughter of the king of Tyre. Now, that was another powerful ally. And, you know, with all those wives that Solomon had, we can see what happened. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and this was the way he made peace with all of his neighbors, evidently. He married enough of the daughters of influential people in order to have peace. And I think we ought to do the same thing as Solomon did, brethren. How would you like that? I don't know that I could stand it. But I'll tell you, what I mean is this. He got rid of all his enemies. As someone said, I guess today, he got rid of all his enemies by making them his friends. As a part of the family, he married the daughters of these influential men, and therefore they couldn't very well be an enemy. He was now a member of the family. Now, that much we can do. Do you have any enemies? Sure you do. I'm sure we all do. You got somebody that doesn't like you, and maybe you don't like them either, and that's wrong. Well, we can get rid of them by making them friends. But not compromising principle, however. We don't ever want you to think that we feel we could compromise principle, but not holding out for the last drop of blood either. Chairman's here, I guess. Time to stop. Well, let me suggest something in closing. We're almost closing. I think Brother Parkinson had that expression. It's almost the end. The kind of thing that I want to think about when I'm going to be king and a priest, if I'm faithful, is I want to bring blessings to those with whom I come in contact. But let me suggest something. That to bring blessings to others in the kingdom, we have to start now. We should ask ourselves a question. Are we bringing blessings to those with whom we meet, those who we see, whether it's on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, or just from once in a while at convention? When people see me coming, what thought comes to their mind? Do they say, oh, here comes David Bruce. I'm so glad he's here. He's such a blessing. Or do they say, here comes that so-and-so, and turn away?
Speak well of your enemies. You made them.
Just thinking, here we've been in an auditorium for chemistry. You know how it is when you take a course in chemistry? You get maybe an hour of theory, just like we've had. But when it comes to the laboratory, they give you maybe 3 or 4 hours of laboratory practice. So the Lord does with us. We've had a convention to get our theory. Now we go home to get our laboratory practice. So when we leave here, we can think about it. We're already working now on our next convention.
Brother David will also ask the Lord's blessing on the closing remarks by Brother David Rice.
Our loving Father, reverently and in the name of Jesus, we approach Thee once again. We do thank Thee, dear Father, for these 3 days of convention and for the provision that has been made on for our spiritual benefit and for our temporal needs. And we praise Thee for it and we thank Thee for it, and those whom Thou hast used here in San Diego to provide that which has been given to us. We have been so much blessed, dear Father. Help us to fully appreciate what we've heard and help us to put into practice in the laboratory of life that which we have heard. Continue with our brethren everywhere in every place. Grant unto each of them according to their needs. We do not know them all, but they are all known to Thee, those all over the world who are serving Thee in spirit and in truth and with whom Thou art dealing. And we leave it all in Thy care and keeping, praying now especially that Thou bless our brother Rice as he ministers to us, and that we together with him may draw closer to each other and to Thee as a result of having been here. And we ask it all and we thank Thee and praise Thee and wait for the full establishment of Thy kingdom. In the precious name of Jesus, amen.